every part of our experience, to not have the feeling that part of us shows up here and then, you know, there's a part that we sort of have to check at the door because it's not, like, Buddhist enough, or it's something that we're ashamed about, or whatever it may be. This is the place where everything is welcome. Your history, the parts about yourself that you love, but that you maybe are afraid sometimes to acknowledge. The way you might actually love yourself. The ways that you might be embarrassed, or that where you feel you make mistakes. Your ancestry, your race, your sexual orientation. All the ways that you may or may not feel like you belong. This is a place where all aspects of you belong. And this is so important, because one of the most important things in order to practice is we have to have a sense of safety. We have to have a sense that we're not defending ourselves. And having a place, I mean, this is a wonderful space and a really warm group of people, and that's why we come together to do this. Because we can together create this sense of safety that includes all aspects of our humanness. And it is so inevitable that when we sit down to practice, all sorts of things happen that we... I was meditating a minute ago. That's not included. Or that's not what I wanted to have happen here. Or what am I doing here anyway? And all those different things. And the key thing in our practice is to keep including all of that. To keep including. And so that comes from right when you come in the door. And as I think I mentioned the other day, I really want to acknowledge your effort to show up here. Just to take this day and do this is a real gift to yourself and to other people and to the world. There are many different things you could have spent today doing. And to make this choice is a beautiful thing. And to acknowledge that in yourself. This is what I prioritize today. So a couple things just about our container. It will be a day of silence, but the silence is such a gift. So I really encourage you, all of you I think have an understanding of the silence, so let yourself rest into it. We get to take care of and tend to each other through our own practice and through being here. We don't need to do it by checking in on each other, trying to make sure somebody's okay, trying to ask somebody if we're okay. Just let each thing come as it is, and let the silence and the sense of sangha and community here hold whatever arises. And I want to say, if you need to move to be comfortable, switch to a chair, you know, go sit there against the wall and lean against it, you know, whatever you need to do to take care of yourself, please do that. You can see in what I'm talking about, there's this interesting combination. We're constantly weaving between discipline and ease. Between really setting our intention and really trying to stay with the practice, but not ramming ourselves up against a wall. You know, not making things more painful than they need to be, or, you know, or resisting what's happening. So we're weaving between this having a safe and full and clear container, and then within that, finding our place of relaxation and ease. So I want to start the day by talking about a few specific things about impermanence. So as you saw from the title, the theme weaving through today is this relationship of impermanence and equanimity. Impermanence is the gateway to equanimity. There are several gateways. Equanimity, if you are familiar with Buddhist lists, is at the end of many lists. It is, you know, the last of the paramitas. It is the fourth of the Brahmaviharas. It is, in the progress of insight, the culmination before the unconditioned. It's in seven factors of enlightenment. I think it's in that one, you know, but it's just in lots and lots of lists. And it's always at the end. I'm pretty sure it's almost every time it's at the end, which tells you that this is not generally where we start. This, we don't just get to get up one morning in our first day, get to have equanimity. And any attempt to skip over to equanimity will just get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. That is the nature of, you've all heard the term spiritual bypass. Mm-hmm. Spiritual bypass is the effort to for everything to be okay without actually getting in there and really being with everything. So the first part of today, I really want to encourage you to reacquaint, because of course it's always there and you've always experienced it, but really let yourself touch moment after moment impermanence. And our practice, our world, we have in our practice, we're looking for truth, right? We want truth, we want kindness, we want to understand this reality. And there's the truth of what's in here, and there's the truth of what's out there. And a lot of times we're working with this relationship. What's happening out there, and how do I respond or react to it? And of course, many of our reactions are the aversion and the clinging and the just not paying attention. I don't really want to see that. And so what we're doing when we really start feeling and paying attention to impermanence is that we're acknowledging the truth of out there. And any place that we resist that, where we argue with reality inside ourselves, we try to open again and again to the truth of the way it is out there. This summer, there was a... I was actually talking on the phone, looking out the window at my house, and there was a little plume of smoke going up. And it took me a minute, and then I said to the person on the phone, I gotta go. And hung up and called the fire department. Behind our house was a riparian corridor, very dense, mostly tamarisk and Russian olive, and quite a few cottonwoods. And the day, there were like 40 mile per hour winds that day. It might have even gusted higher than that. And within 5 minutes, everything changed. The little plume of smoke had turned into a huge flame, and the wind was just whipping it across, right behind the house. And everything was up for grabs, right? Anything could happen. An hour before, I was on the phone. I think I was doing something in the kitchen. And then for the rest of the day, this fire went by. It came within 150 feet of our house. It was, you know, it was fire trucks, and then it turned and came back again, and the fire chief was there, and the houses on the other side. And it was this whole thing. And in the midst of it, of course, I had to, it wasn't looking very good, and so I had to do the quick walk through the house. Okay, what are the... what's the one car full of stuff that I'm going to take with me? My husband had fallen off a ladder that morning and had hurt his heel, and so couldn't really walk. So he was in the waiting in the car for most of the day. Two friends managed to get through the barricades and were helping with water and sprinklers and things like that. But that was an interesting exercise. What's actually important? And it was actually surprising to me, you know, if you can only take a few things, it almost like you can hardly even figure out what few things, you know? What do you bother with? You know, I thought, oh, and I went for actually the things that were going to be a hassle, you know, replacing the driver's license and the passport and the, you know, the things that were going to make my life difficult. And then it passed. It was sort of back to normal. And then the next thing was that my view changed. You know, now I could see all the way across the burnt landscape out to, you know, some trailers and things in the distance. And then I watched the green come back. There was a set of reeds that, boy, did they burn hot. There was this big, dense, you can't even walk in it, area of reeds, and burned, whew, impressive. And then burned down flat, and then the green. It was just this carpet coming up again. And it just keeps changing. No telling. And one of the hardest things that we have to deal with in change, the one that bumps up against us that we all deny, is death. I know the Buddha was really had teachings about death, and you may have known the story about you might know the woman with the mustard seed.
Oh yes.
So a woman comes, she's gone crazy with, she's mad because she's lost her child has died, and she's just crazed, and she comes to the Buddha and she's like, oh, I'm so crazy, make him alive. And the Buddha says, yeah, okay, I can do that. Just find me one mustard seed from a household that hasn't been touched by death, and I'll help you out. So she walks to, she said, oh, no problem. And so she goes to the first household and says, oh, do you have mustard seed? They say, oh, yeah, yeah. And by the way, has anybody here died? And he said, oh, yeah. And she, oh, never mind. She goes to the next and the next. She figured it out. That this is part of what happens. I have two women that I know, both of which, and actually a little caveat I need to name because I forgot to name it on Thursday night. Those of you who know me already know this, is that when I tell stories and things that touch me, I tend to get very teary and choke up. Nothing's wrong. That's just what happens for me. So that will undoubtedly happen. Because I know two different mothers who have lost their sons in their 20s. The sons were in their 20s. And I think every mother knows this is the worst fear of any parent. And both of them had, you know, troubled kids. And one woman became, from that incredible suffering, her talking about when she doesn't even remember. From the moment she was told, she blacked out for the first 3 days. You know, she doesn't even recall it. And then she developed a very, very deep practice. And over the years, she was told by many people that this is something that you will always carry. This loss is just something that a mother carries, and you'll develop a relationship with it. And it was a beautiful thing. She called me. It wasn't very long ago. It was maybe about a year ago or something, because she's a dear friend. And she said, I've realized that it has completely passed. There is no hook in it for me anymore. My relationship with my son is everywhere. And there's no bitterness, there's no pain. I've completely come to terms with it. And then I know another woman who has lost her son and has not gotten over it. And the bitterness and sadness in the heart can completely shut down as a response to this thing that happened. And none of this is to underestimate, to under acknowledge the amount of suffering involved. But to actually come to terms with the truth gives us freedom. To continue to cling to it is to hold on to that suffering and resist the impermanence. And there's no way out there. I think it's in the Bhagavad Gita that, I can't remember, the god was asked, you know, what's the most amazing thing in the world? And the answer, he says, the most amazing thing in the world is that people see people dying all around them and think it will never happen to them. It will. It will. And this clinging, this holding on, trying to resist what will happen, what has happened, this is our argument, making an argument with reality. Arguing with the truth of what is. And it's no help. It's no help. And it actually blocks our continued relationship with what is arising. If you're stuck hanging on to how things should be or how they shouldn't be or how they, then you can't actually connect with the truth of this moment. Your relationship with the world has stopped. You are no longer in relationship. You are stuck in here. Ajahn Chah says, if you see certainty in that which is uncertain, you are bound to suffer. Sounds pretty true. I was recently a friend and I'm a fan of Terry Tempest Williams. And she, for those of you who don't know, she's a writer and really quite a wonderful writer in my mind. And she was recently talking and she said that some people have said to her, somebody, you seem to be married to sorrow. And she said, no, I just don't choose to turn away. And my curiosity is greater than my fear. I think that is what we, when we come to practice, what we are acknowledging in ourselves, that we have the courage and the curiosity is greater than our fear and our shying away and our wanting to stay in our tight little box and hide. And we have to renew that over and over again. We have to take a deep breath and say, okay, I can turn towards this too. And this too may be something just the next breath, just letting go of some way that you're being right, some way that somebody has harmed you or that you have harmed someone else, and being willing to say, I see it, I understand, and I'm not going to stay right there. I'm not going to get lost in that. And I like the quote, it's a brave person who wants to hear what she doesn't want to hear. Brave person who wants to hear what you, and you are here hearing what you don't want to hear. And that's a lot, takes a lot of courage. So in our practice today, as we settle in here, I want to encourage you over and over to find the places where you are in resistance to this impermanent flow, where you're hanging on to a thought, where you want something to be a certain way, or you wanted it either in the past or in the future. And each time you see that, see if you can come back to the truth in this moment. And it may take a while. You know, we have to go through a pattern, right? Sometimes we actually have to go, oh, I'm really, really stuck, I'm really stuck. And then you have to see, yes, this is stuckness. And that's fine. Now you're starting to have a relationship with what's true. And then you go from there. Can I just become unstuck? That's a good question. Can I become unstuck? Sometimes we can become unstuck by simply noticing we're stuck. Or that we've been, when I'm stuck, I should use maybe something more general, just that we're lost. Right? So we start the day perhaps with paying attention to our breath, and we drift off and we notice I'm lost in thought, come back. You know, it's really simple. Mindfulness and that habit over and over again of coming back, cultivates its own, you know, what are you practicing in this moment? Each moment you practice mindfulness, coming back to the breath, creates the possibility and the more likelihood the next moment you will also be mindful and the one after that. So we first just bring our mindfulness, and that's often enough. Sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes we're stuck and we're really hanging on. And then it might be useful to go, why am I hanging on? What am I clinging to here? And, you know, the Buddhist said, there's nothing whatsoever to be clung to. Nothing whatsoever. But you might go, yeah, but I really need to call this person and tell them what I think, because what they did was not appropriate and was not useful. Do you really need to cling to that? That's a question you can ask yourself. Do you need to cling to that in order to have to act? Do you need to cling to that in order to get through this moment? In order to get through the next moment? In order at the end of the day, even to make a phone call, to say something to somebody, do you need to cling to that in this moment? How is that helping you? I remember I was starting a new work at a place, and someone was supposedly training me. It wasn't their forte, in my view. And then it kept turning out that, like, the way I would do it, thinking I was trying to do it, wasn't the way they wanted it done. And this went on and on, and I could just see that also the way that they were doing it, that it didn't seem like it mattered, you know? And then I would just keep coming back. Do I want to be right and suffer? Or do I want to be free? Choice is mine. And I go, I don't really want to be right that bad. And I would just let it go. Doesn't matter. If you put it on yellow paper, you put it on orange paper. It was actually making schedules. Orange paper, yellow paper. Whatever. Then, you know, if it has to be on orange paper, I'll just make sure there's orange paper. You know? So I just was like, okay. It doesn't have to be that much. Some things are harder for us. And often, in order to let go of deeper things that have been here a long time, there is a process of unfolding that has to occur. We turn our attention to it, and we may say, I really have a lot of energy in this. I am really angry with this person. I'm really angry. And then we go, if we really just get into that relationship, yep, there's a lot of anger here. What is really here then? And this is where we drop into our body. We feel what anger feels like in our body. We feel what it's like in our mind. We sense how it may be familiar, all the times we've been angry. And we actually then stop clinging to the idea that it needs to be different. So this is so important, because sometimes mindfulness just makes something go away that doesn't really need to be there. But if something has a lot of energy in it, it's going to be there. And then the not being in argument with the way things are includes not arguing with this is how I feel. This is what's happening. The trick is, the safety of a day like this is that we know we're not going to act that out. We're not going to yell at anybody. We're not going to throw anything. So we can let ourselves feel this and actually say, oh, this is what it's like. this is what anger is like. This is what all the angers of the world are like. I have another friend who's a mother who, her son is a extreme kayaker who goes to foreign countries and does first descents down waterfalls and things, and she doesn't hear from him for months, and she has no idea, and a number of his friends have died. This is not, you know, her concerns are not made up. Her relationship with that, her feeling into that deeply, was one of her, when she felt into it and really felt that incredible agony of being a mother, and she realized the agony of all mothers, of all beings, that was her gateway into incredible awakening. So there was no resistance that I shouldn't be worrying. No, this worrying is actually this incredible thing that is telling me so much about the world. And it's true that another skill that is helpful, in addition to not arguing with one the way things are and to get in there, is to know when to back up and to just use an antidote. So that means if you have incredible sorrow or incredible anger and you're just getting lost in it, it's overwhelming, it's too much, it's so skillful to say, okay, I need some space here. How about some metta for myself, metta for other, just pay attention to my body sitting here, the sky. So giving ourselves space. And that's actually, I'll talk a lot more about this sense of space that we can have in which everything arises as we go through the day. So I'm going to read you two quotes from the Buddha. All things conditioned are unstable, impermanent, fragile in essence, as an unbaked pot, like something borrowed, or a city founded on sand. They last only a short while and are inevitably destroyed, like plaster washed off in the rains. Like the sandy bank of a river, they are conditioned and their true nature is frail. They are like the flame of a lamp which rises suddenly and soon goes out. They have no power of endurance, like the wind or like foam, unsubstantial, essentially feeble, nothing to hold on to. The sage knows what is true reality and sees all conditioned things as empty and powerless. And then in case that seems too heavy, as if there's no joy in it, William Blake saw this, but sees the flip side. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. What I'd like to invite you to do, if you're willing, is begin your practice laying down. The reason I have people start out laying down is that it's really our tension in our body, our holding, our pain that we just go through the day with. It's it really hard. And laying down and relaxing helps start our day with some ease.